Hi, I'm Francesca, a registered nutritional therapist, and you're listening to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast. Welcome. My aim is to bring you down-to-earth, conversational episodes that help you develop a deeper understanding of how your body's changing in your 40s, and most importantly, how you can support yourself throughout this wonderful transitional phase of your life. Join me for my solo episodes and also episodes with guests for fun, fresh, truthful chat on all things health and happiness in your 40s. And now on to the episode. Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast with me, your host, Francesca. It is great to be back this week, specifically because I've actually spent 3.5 weeks of January in Thailand with my partner. So before I left, which was New Year's Eve, I pre-recorded a few episodes just so that they could still continue to be released every week while I was away. So if you've listened to those while I've been away, then thank you. And I hope that you've found those helpful. And now that I'm back on sort of recording every week in advance is what I'm doing. So at the time of recording this, it is just the last couple of days of January. It's the 28th of January. And I'm feeling the jet lag still. It's kind of taking me quite a while to get over this one, I guess, crossing 7 time zones and coming back to really miserable weather, as lucky as we were to avoid the first 3 weeks of January in the UK, which was amazing. It's still a bit of a, like, it really hit hard when we landed last week and it's just so cold. So I think that's one of the other reasons it's taken so long for me to feel like I'm coming back into the normal sort of UK time zone. But it's really great to be back and sitting here now, nearly February, and I've managed to bypass the kind of first few miserable weeks of January. So I'm very grateful for that. So in today's episode, this kind of follows on from last week's. If you haven't listened to last week's episode, do go back and listen to that. It would be better to listen to it before this one, but you don't necessarily have to. This one will still make sense. It just does follow on nicely from last week's episode, because I talked about, which is what I'm going to continue with today, how the body basically processes our old or, you know, used up estrogen. Once the body's used the estrogen and the estrogen has done all the right things it's meant to be doing, all its fabulous things that it does for us in the body, we do need to basically use it and lose it. It needs to be removed from the body efficiently and quite quickly. We don't want to risk any kind of old molecules of estrogen staying in the body. We also don't want to put them through half of the breakdown process, but then risk reabsorbing them back into the system, which hopefully will make sense by the end of this session, episode. So it is really important that we have, you know, our systems are working really well, specifically our liver, gallbladder, and our gut, which is what we're focusing on today, that they're working efficiently in order to break down our used estrogen and get it cleared out of the body permanently. So in this episode, I'm going to fill you in on how the gut is involved in that process, but also just generally how gut health can impact our experience during perimenopause with regards to our symptoms, because our gut health is very closely linked to health, the balance, and the behavior of our hormones. And equally, as we move into perimenopause, the change in hormones there can start to impact our gut. And then our gut can impact our hormones. So it can be this kind of two-way link that can be a bit of a vicious cycle. Now, you might be thinking, but I don't have any digestive symptoms, so gut health just isn't an issue for me, right? But that just isn't true. So whilst suboptimal gut health can show up obviously as obvious sort of symptoms related to the gut, you know, your typical irritable bowel syndrome set of symptoms like bloating, flatulence, constipation, loose stools, diarrhea, indigestion, for example. Even without these so-called obvious gut-related symptoms, your gut health might still be off, might still be out of balance, and could be impacting your hormones. So, for example, we don't always feel malabsorption, let's say, maldigestion. If we're not properly breaking down our foods and we're not effectively, therefore, absorbing the nutrients from those foods, then we're not always going to feel the effects of that by way of typical gut symptoms, but it would be felt in the form instead of low energy, fatigue, low mood, anxiety, brain fog, headaches, And these are also your typical perimenopause symptoms. So whilst anybody can suffer with these symptoms at any stage in their life, due to whether it's due to, you know, unhealthy gut, malabsorption, other things, these are your typical perimenopause symptoms. So it is very important once we move past 40 that we're not just putting everything down to being in perimenopause. Oh, it's just perimenopause, I just have to deal with it. Yes, it's important to have that awareness of what happens in perimenopause, how our hormones change and how that impacts us and how we can, you know, minimize its impact. That's exactly what my job is. It's what I do on a day-to-day basis. It's why I, you know, have the Empowered Perimenopause podcast and run my own business and help people one-to-one, etc. But we still don't want to just put everything down to perimenopause. We want to be thinking, okay, well, do I need to look at my thyroid health? Do I need to look at my gut health? You know, do I need to check to see if there's any, you know, nutrient deficiencies or any infections or any inflammation? We want to constantly be kind of keeping an eye on any certain areas of our health that could be impacting. So gut health being one of them. So in this episode, I'm going to dive into how your gut health is connected to your hormones and the impact it can have. And from here, you can start to see if gut health might be something that you want to start addressing for yourself. We'll end with lots of lovely tips about how you can start to improve and optimize your gut health for yourself. Now, perimenopause is a shift in estrogen and progesterone. So you've got the erratic nature of estrogen. You know, it's going, it's fluctuating wildly, more wildly than it ever has before. And those highs and lows, those sharp drops and the spikes, they have an impact on the body and how we feel. It's a eventual decline of estrogen starts to occur later phases of later stages of perimenopause, so later 40s upwards. And then we have this decline in progesterone, which is happening much earlier on in the perimenopause stages. So anywhere from late 30s, early 40s, progesterone is the first of the two hormones to actually start to shift. And that's by way of its decline. So I do have an episode right at the beginning. I think it's episodes two and three of this podcast, where I really do break down all of those stages. So if you haven't listened to those, do go back and listen to those. So that shift in estrogen and progesterone that perimenopause is, basically research has shown that these changes in estrogen and progesterone can cause issues within our gut, within our intestines, that can soon result in chronic low-grade inflammation, which is what many women, particularly during perimenopause, can be dealing with, whether knowingly or unknowingly, just due to those changes in so many different shifts and, you know, things that are going on with our hormones that are impacting other systems. But the gut health is very strongly linked to this situation of chronic low-grade inflammation. So that's what the research is showing, is that the shift in hormones during perimenopause is impacting the health of our gut and our intestines. Your estrogens and your progesterone, they generally play a positive protective role in supporting our digestive system, the intestines, and all of the trillions of microbes that we have living in there, which is known as our gut microbiome. So the microbiome is basically the collection of all the different microbes, the different bacteria that should live in our gut as part of the normal, healthy gut environment. We also have, for example, a vaginal microbiome. We have skin microbiome. So it basically means a collection of microbes that should be in these places. But today we're obviously talking about the gut microbiome. So estrogens and progesterones have been shown to play a positive protective role in supporting the amount of healthy bacteria that's there, the diversity, the different strains, and all of the, you know, allowing the protective types of bacteria to thrive. That's what, you know, the estrogens and progesterone have been shown to protect, and also to protect the digestive system as a whole, digestion as a whole, the intestines. So of course, the change in estrogen and progesterone during perimenopause is likely to cause, and menopause once we eventually stop making those hormones completely, is likely to cause some kind of imbalances in the gut. And what's been shown is that estrogen and progesterone during perimenopause, and of course menopause itself, has been shown to cause a decrease in the diversity. So the different types of gut bacteria, it's been shown to cause a decrease in the different types of gut bacteria, those microbes, which is not what we want, because a diverse community, so lots of different strains and types, is really protective. We don't just want one particular strain to dominate. We want lots of different strains all in healthy balance. It's the shift in estrogen and progesterone has also been shown to cause changes in what's known as the tight junctions within your gut lining that keeps things basically from seeping out of the intestines that shouldn't seep out of the intestines, shouldn't leave the gut and get into the bloodstream. If particles, for example, particular toxins that we might have ingested, undigested food particles, maybe from, not breaking down our food properly, any kind of pathogens that should stay in the gut, or shouldn't even be in the gut, but let's say they should stay in the gut anyway, if they are there, and they should not be allowed to seep through into the bloodstream. If they do, this is something, a situation also known as leaky gut or intestinal permeability. It basically means that if these substances are allowed to pass through the gut lining, it elicits an immune response. So the immune system basically gets involved. It activates. It says, whoa, what is all this? What is this foreign substance? It's not supposed to be here. And that causes an inflammatory response. So if somebody always has, an ongoing situation where their gut lining isn't very strong, so these so-called tight junctions are not tightly packed together, holding that gut lining really, really strong, like a sieve where nothing gets through those holes in the sieve other than water. If those holes get bigger, then you get little bits of pasta falling through the sieve, little bits of rice falling through the sieve. That's what we don't want. We want really, really tight junctions there so that nothing can get through. If we're in a situation where those holes are allowing these toxins, undigested food particles, pathogens, etc., to actually seep through into the bloodstream, we can then be in a situation where we have this chronic low-grade inflammation. And this has a role in the progression of autoimmunity as well, and just muscle aches and pains, joint pain, all these lots of different things can be caused by low-grade inflammation, which I have talked about in previous episodes. But just for the sake of keeping this more simple, that's all I kind of want you to know today. So those two major shifts of what has been shown that estrogen and progesterone's changes during perimenopause and menopause can cause. So it's decreased diversity in levels of protective gut bacteria and changes to those tight junctions of the intestine, making it become more leaky, or intestinal permeability is also known as. So these changes in the microbiome in your intestines, they've been linked to increases as well in things like blood glucose levels, increased cholesterol, increased risk for type 2 diabetes, increased visceral fat gain, which is not what we want, worse inflammatory symptoms, as I just mentioned, like joint pain, headaches, fatigue, and even things like heartburn, gas, bloating, and your typical sort of, GI, gastrointestinal symptoms that you would relate to your gut. So lots of things there that we don't want to happen. So that's why it's just really, really important, even if you don't have typical gut symptoms, it's really important that you look to be supporting your gut health, optimizing your gut health at all times. Because we don't have typical gut symptoms, it doesn't mean everything's great, everything's okay in our gut. And if we're going through perimenopause and we're having those changes, obviously, to our hormones, then we're probably not going to be exempt from gut imbalances. And, I could also go on about the impact of stress and our fast-paced modern world and day-to-day life and all that, and what that does on the gut. That in and of itself, whether you're in perimenopause or not, can cause issues. So again, it's just that double whammy when we move through perimenopause and into menopause. And as well, if you have imbalances in the gut, it's going to exacerbate pretty much any hormone-related symptom, that you can think of, and vice versa. So the balance of our microbiome, so that's the community of the gut bugs, microbes, plays a huge role in regulating inflammation as well. So we want to have these tight junctions in the lining of the gut, the intestines, to make sure that none of these toxic particles, seep through from the gut into the bloodstream. But then there's also the fact that the community of gut bugs play a huge role in also regulating any inflammation, because essentially they do support the integrity of the gut wall, that gut lining. And they also support, they also play a big role in breaking down or processing our hormones, which is what we're basically going to focus on more today. So in the previous episode, as I said, I talked about the two phases of estrogen breakdown that occur primarily in the liver. So that's phase one and phase two. So we use an estrogen molecule, which is happening all day, every day. It then goes into the liver and it goes through phase one estrogen breakdown. So this is a process where we just, the liver is there's a multi-step process of breaking down that estrogen molecule. And then it goes through phase two, which does something else to that molecule. And then from phase two, that broken down estrogen then gets sent to the gut via the gallbladder through the bile to the gut to be passed out of the body permanently. So this would be the gut, the gallbladder and the gut is known as the third and final phase of estrogen detox. The first two happening in the liver and the third and final phase happening in the gut. So go back and listen to the previous episode if you haven't already, because I do break down those two liver phases in detail. So the final phase of moving estrogen out of the body is via a bowel movement, basically. There are also some other ways that the gut is involved in successful estrogen breakdown and clearance. I'm going to explain that in this episode as well. So essentially, your digestion and your gut health, they're so important for much more than you might think. It's not just about, you know, preventing, like I said, flatulence, bloating, constipation, the typical, you know, heartburn, indigestion, like the typical gut symptoms. It's not just about preventing those symptoms. It plays a huge role in managing inflammation, managing autoimmunity, joint pain, brain inflammation, fatigue, low energy, headaches, you know, cognition, so many different things, and also our ability to clear out our used hormones, which is very, very important. So let's now have a look in at the gut's role, essentially, in breaking down and clearing out your estrogen. But just to recap, estrogen detoxification or estrogen clearance is also known as estrogen metabolism, and it refers to how your body, as I said, particularly the liver and then the gut, breaks down and clears out your used estrogen from your body, which is occurring all day, every day. And this process needs to be efficient in order for us to keep our hormones balanced, basically. We don't want old estrogen remaining in the body. It needs to come out straight away. And this applies whether you're, you know, whatever stage you are in your life, even post-menopause, we still need to be the small amount of estrogen we're able to make post-menopause. We still need to efficiently process it. And if we're on hormone replacement therapy of estrogen, we even more so, we need to be able to process it really well. So we have to, when it comes to estrogen, we have to use it and lose it, no matter what stage we are in life. But obviously, my focus is the perimenopause phase. So it's even more important now, more than ever, because we're in a phase of life where we do have more of an imbalance between estrogen and progesterone, where progesterone is actually declining very early on in perimenopause and throughout. And estrogen is actually higher than it's ever been before until the later stages of perimenopause. And the last thing we want is to add to this the higher levels of estrogen and the erratic nature of estrogen. We don't want to add to this picture by not being able to efficiently clear out the estrogen that we've used, because it just causes issues for us. So we discussed how this all goes down in the liver, as I said, in a previous episode. And then after the liver phases have worked their efficient magic, we hope, the broken down estrogen gets swiftly moved through the bile into your intestines. It's either or into your kidneys. So we can wee it out via the kidneys. That's where some of it goes. And then the rest of it, the bulk of it, I'd say, sits in your gut waiting to be passed out via a bowel movement. And note as well here that even if you don't have a gallbladder, you will still make bile in your liver. So this does still apply. You do not want these broken down estrogens that occur in the liver phase one and phase two to sit in your gut for long at all. They need to be passed out daily via a fully formed, healthy bowel movement. So at least once a day, if you're not having a healthy bowel movement, at least once a day, you're likely reabsorbing that estrogen that was processed in phases one and two in the liver back into your body, back into circulation, rather than getting it out permanently. And that's bad news for your estrogen levels and then the symptoms that come with your situation of, say, excess or unopposed estrogen, so estrogen that isn't healthily balanced out with progesterone. And that would be things like heavy, painful periods, clotting, worse PMS with mood swings, breast pain or breast swelling, headaches, weight gain, growth of fibroids or cysts, acne breakouts, and even an increased risk of hormone estrogen-driven cancers. So basically, the efficiency of phase three relies on a healthy gut microbiome, so a healthy collection of bacteria living in the gut, great diversity, good amounts, and your daily healthy bowel movements. And actually, we can call the healthy gut microbiome part of this phase 2.5, and then we move on to phase three, which is the bowel movement, permanently getting rid of the broken down estrogen via a bowel movement. So let's have a look at phase 2.5 then. So first of all, let's have a look at the gut microbiome, the collection of bacteria. So what's important to know here, well, it's not necessarily important that you remember these names or anything, but it's just helpful for your understanding, is that the relationship between that collection of bacteria, the microbiome in your gut, and your ability to successfully eliminate your used estrogen from your body is known as the estrobilome, estro meaning estrogen. So the estrobilome is essentially, in simple terms, it's a collection of bacteria in the gut that metabolize and regulate. So they help to break down and regulate your used estrogen. That's the estrogen that's just been processed in your liver and then sent into your gut for elimination. So this is what the estrobilome is essentially doing. It's metabolizing and regulating your estrogen. But where can this all go wrong? So certain strains of bacteria inside your so-called estrobilome can produce high levels of an enzyme called beta-glucuronidase. So this would be, when I say certain strains, this would be when the gut microbiome has become a situation where we have, let's say, lower diversity of protective strains, lower abundance of protective strains, and some of the more harmful strains have been allowed to grow and thrive and take a hold. So they're now running the show, and the protective diverse strains aren't really, you know, they're there, but they're not kind of running the show. So when this happens, those more harmful types of bacteria are now able to produce high levels of this enzyme called beta-glucuronidase. This enzyme has the ability to split apart the previously processed estrogens from their, let's call them like kind of carrier molecule, like a little taxi that they're attached to in the gut, which was waiting to take them out, escort them out of the body permanently via a bowel movement. This beta-glucuronidase enzyme can split that apart. It can split the little taxi away from the estrogen molecule and send that estrogen molecule back into circulation within your body rather than letting it go out via a stool. So whether it's that you don't have daily bowel movements, really good quality ones, which is phase three, and or you have high levels of certain strains of bacteria that increase the levels of this enzyme beta-glucuronidase, you could be reabsorbing your used estrogens and suffering with the symptoms and situations that can bring. As I just mentioned, you know, the painful, heavy periods and so on, breast pain, mood swings, anxiety even, and also even driving conditions like endometriosis and, as I said, growth of fibroids and increasing the risk of estrogen-driven cancer. So this isn't to, you know, terrify anybody at all. It's just to be aware that the gut is so much more than just, you know, looking after our gut, I should say. It's so much more than just making sure we don't have any gut symptoms. It actually plays such a huge role in helping to balance our hormone levels as well. So essentially, you want to be passing a fully formed snake-like stool at least once a day, and then have good levels, good abundance and diversity of friendly bacteria strains, so protective bacteria strains in your gut. And we also want the absence of gut infections, you know, like parasites, high levels of pathogenic bacteria strains. We will always have some unfriendly bacteria strains in our gut. We just want them to be really minimal. We don't want them to be running the show. We ideally don't want to have any colonization of yeasts and molds, which is also known as mycotoxicity. And that can come, for example, from living in mold. If you've been there long enough, it can start that mold, that yeast can start to colonize in your gut, for example. Now, you wouldn't really know if you have, you know, the presence of particular, some parasites, some of the really most well-known, you know, like H. pylori and C. diff, maybe your GP could run those tests for you. But there's lots of other types of parasites that may not necessarily be picked up via the GP because they're not necessarily, you know, harmful to health as such. So your average GP isn't really going to be looking at those. What you would need to do is a private comprehensive stool test. So, for example, the one that I run with some of my clients is called GI Effects, which is by a lab called Genova Diagnostics. It isn't cheap. It's about £355, to be exact. That's how much it was last time I ordered it. And that provides me with a comprehensive assessment of the person's gut health, including whether they have these elevated levels of that enzyme, beta-glucuronidase, whether they have certain parasites, pathogenic bacteria, whether that's climbing too high, whether they have any yeast infections, any mold, colonization. And you wouldn't really see that unless you do this kind of private test. But as I said, it is quite costly. So in the absence of doing that test, you can just simply start to address and look after your gut health now, whether to prevent these issues from manifesting or to reverse them if it's already the case for you. If you do have these things and you're not testing, so you don't know, doing the things that we're going to talk about in a minute to help improve your gut health can still be extremely helpful in order, you know, but in helping to increase, for example, friendly bacteria and decrease the unfriendly bacteria. And if there is any yeast, if there is any pathogenic bacteria, just looking after your gut by way of the tips we talk about today can help to reduce those things, whether you do a test or not, to know that they're there. So eating meals every day that are rich in quality fiber, vitamins, minerals, and staying properly hydrated, you know, keeping your colon properly hydrated, is really essential for supporting regular bowel movements. And my favorite tips for improving your bowel movements, their frequency, and supporting your estrobilome, so that collection of bacteria that's processing your used estrogens, are what we'll go through now. So I've got quite a few of them, and that will take us to the end of the episode. So hopefully you so far understand what I'm kind of explaining about the gut's role in our hormone health and vice versa. And then you can just take away these tips and pick and choose which ones you kind of want to start working on. Maybe you're already doing some and you just need to add in a few, or, you know, maybe you're not doing any of them, but you're just going to start with one and move slowly through them all. So firstly, we want to be making sure that every day we're eating a wider variety, diversity of different colours and types of vegetables, essentially plant foods, which includes vegetables, herbs, spices, fruits, particularly berries, beans and pulses and lentils. So, you know, any of your typical plant foods, looking at the different colours, the different types, and being more diverse in your shopping, you know, so that you've, for example, you're not, okay, so an example I give of this is years and years ago, before I trained to be a nutritionist, I was really pleased with myself because I ate spinach every day and cabbage, so green cabbage and spinach every single day on baby tomatoes and chicken. So I went to see a nutritional therapist, I think this was like 15 years ago now, and I thought she'd be so pleased with me, and she just said, you know, it's good that you're eating these plants, but you have three plants every day. And I thought, oh my goodness, I just didn't realize. So well, how many should I be having? And she said, well, 20 to 30 different plants every day. And we still actually use that guidance today, because it is actually more achievable than you might think. So for example, I went away from that session and really thought about it, went to the supermarket, started walking through the fruit and veg aisles, and thought, yeah, okay, I can see now what I've been doing. So it's looking at things like purple cabbage, green cabbage, white cabbage, spinach, kale, the purples, the oranges, the greens. So you've got your greens covered if you buy all your different green veg. But then looking at those other ones as well, yellows, oranges, so different bell peppers. If you only ever buy the red one, maybe start buying the yellow and the orange and having a bit of both. You know, carrots, butternut squash, the different squashes. If you rely on potatoes, can you mix it up with sweet potatoes, red potatoes, white potatoes, even with rice. So there's red rice, there's black rice, there's brown rice, you know, mix it up like that as well. Different beans. If you always just eat chickpeas, maybe just try kidney beans as well, and lentils and butter beans and black beans. So you're increasing the diversity of the types of vegetables that you have. And then think of fresh herbs, dried herbs. So for example, let's just say I'm just going to give an example of a salad that you might whip up at lunchtime that contains 10 types of plants. So you could chop in some. So let's say you have watercress, rocket spinach as your base. That's 3. You chop up some red onion, some tomatoes. You'll shred in some carrot. You might shred in some beetroot. You might slice up some red chili to put in there if you like a spicy salad. You might put some avocado in there. What else could you put in there? And some lentils. So that's 10. And then you'll put your bigger sort of protein in there, maybe some chicken, some eggs, some fish, whatever it might be for you. And then you've got 10 plants in there. And you can see that you could easily put more in there if you wanted to. You could chop in spring onion as well. You know, there's lots of other options. So it's quite easy if you are just making an effort to you know, think outside the box and have all these different colours and types. It's actually quite easy, much easier than you think, to have 20 to 30 different plants a day. Even things like parsley, fresh parsley, fresh coriander, they can be thrown into your salad as well. So that's another 2 really easily. And then again, you've got dinner, you know, you've got options at breakfast as well. So that would be the absolute biggest piece of advice, is having a wider diversity of colours and types of all different plants throughout the week. Eating prebiotic fibers and resistant starches is also really helpful. So prebiotic foods are the type of fiber that allows the beneficial bacteria to thrive, to kind of take a hold in the gut and grow. So prebiotic fiber foods include onions, garlic, leeks, asparagus, Jerusalem artichoke, which is actually really nice, just chopped up, and you can put them in the air fryer with some olive oil and some. Sorry, my brain is just not online yet since I got back and I'm still a little bit jet lagged. So sea salt and olive oil. It makes lovely kind of crisps, even Jerusalem artichoke crisps, if you like. So that's a lovely prebiotic fiber. And then you've got resistant starches. So these are also a form of prebiotic fibers. And there are 4 types, and some can work better for you than others. So you can just give it all a try. So for example, you've got resistant starch that's found in the coating of seeds, nuts, grains, and pulses. So lentils, beans, you know, sunflower, pumpkin seeds, all your different nuts as well. So if you're just including those sorts of things in your diet every day, then that's great. And also fermentable resistant starch fibers that you find in green bananas or less ripe bananas. And there's also this thing where you can buy raw potato powder. So essentially you can add that into your smoothies or into your yogurt, and that is a very good form of resistant starch. You can also buy inulin powder, which is another form of resistant starch in powder form. And then the resistant starch that's made when it's made when some of the naturally occurring starches in, for example, white potatoes and rice and even pasta are cooked and then allowed to cool. So it sounds crazy, but it's really simple. So if we eat cooked and cooled starchy foods, like, as I said, white potatoes, rice, pastas, that actually has resistant starch compared to if we just ate it cooked and straight away. So that's great. You know, if we're looking at leftovers, if we're looking at having cold potato salads or putting rice through our salads the next day after having cooked it before. So that's a nice form of adding resistant starch into your meals. And then add more probiotic foods. So these are the foods that contain some live bacteria. Aim to have 1 cup a day of any of these. So raw, unpasteurized sauerkraut and or kimchi. So that's your fermented vegetables, basically. Kefir. So if you are going to use kefir, so this is fermented, traditionally it's fermented yogurt. But if you want to avoid cow's milk in case it is inflammatory for you or it doesn't really work for your gut, you can actually buy kefir that's water-based or coconut water-based. I think you might even be able to get it from goat's milk as well. I think you can. Live natural yogurt, so unflavored, full-fat live yogurt can also be helpful. And if you want to drink some kombucha, just make sure it's unflavored, they haven't added any nasties to it, and that the only sugar that's in there is the sugar that they use to actually ferment, to actually make the kombucha itself. And then 1 to 2 tablespoons of ground flaxseed a day is really helpful because it's both, so linseed, so flaxseed is also known as linseed, but you want to make sure you grind it. There's no point having whole flaxseed because they're so tiny, no one can chew them and break them apart. So they're essentially just going to go through your system, you know, in one end, out the other. So do make sure you're grinding your flaxseed. I just use my NutriBullet and I've got a grinding fixture for it, like you'd grind coffee beans. And then I do that once a week. I just grind up a load of flax seeds once a week, keep it in an airtight container in the fridge. So that's why, that way I know it's fresh. It hasn't just been sat there for months on end. And basically it contains, it's both a source of soluble and insoluble fiber, which can help to encourage healthier, regular bowel movement. So it's really helpful for adding bulk to your stool. And then additionally, flaxseed contains something known as lignans. So this is a class of phytoestrogens, so basically plant estrogens that can have an estrogen-like effect in the body. They can bind very weakly to the estrogen cell receptors in the body and positively modulate our estrogen levels in the body. So it's got kind of like a nice positive double whammy of ground flaxseed. So I'm always saying 1 to 2 tablespoons a day. I throw mine into a smoothie. Sometimes if I'm not having a smoothie, I'll just throw it on top of a salad or mix it into a meal. You know, at the end, when it's on my plate, I'll just throw it on top and mix it in. If I've got like a wet meal, like a curry or something, because you can't taste it. And then we want to be making sure, you know, following on from anything that helps to add bulk to the stool to improve our bowel movements, we also want to be making that we're proper, making sure we're properly hydrated, that the colon is properly hydrated with water and also quality electrolytes, so your sodium, potassium, magnesium. So that can include clean water, sometimes sparkling water, herbal teas throughout the day as well. Basically, in terms of knowing whether you're hydrated or not, you want to be checking for very pale urine, so kind of like the color of straw or hay, and that's how you'll know if you're properly hydrated. If it's very dark yellow, or if you know, if it's just too yellow, then you can be you can assume that you're slightly dehydrated and probably need to increase your water intake. The first urine of the morning, if we don't go, you know, we don't go throughout the night, and we haven't had any water since earlier in the evening the day before, the first urine of the morning is likely to be very dark. But then from the rest of the day onwards, after we've had some hydration in the morning, we want to make sure that we keep it a kind of straw or hay color. And one of the most important tips is to chew our food properly. So actually, I should have put this first, because no matter how good your diet is, if you don't chew your meals, you don't chew every single mouthful fully, almost to liquid before you swallow it, you're not going to break down that food very well. And this means that you'll then have undigested food particles sitting in the gut with nowhere to go. And what happens is the bacteria in our gut, the kind of unfriendly bacteria, which is inevitable that we have some in the gut, starts to basically break down this undigested, these big particles of food that haven't been broken down. They start to ferment that food particle. They love it. It's like food for them. So number one, it allows them to thrive in the gut and then grow. And then you have higher levels of unfriendly bacteria. But it also causes bloating, flatulence, loose stools, constipation, all of these bad things that we don't want. So we must make sure that we're taking a mouthful in, placing our knife and fork down while we just chew to almost liquid, and then swallow. Now, I'm guilty of this, so I'm not saying this with any judgment at all, because this is something I have been working on literally for the last 15 years or so. And when I've got, you know, busy days, I'm like, oh, I'm just going to quickly eat this. And you're constantly thinking ahead while you're eating. You just need to get this finished because you need to get on with this. And I have to remind myself every single day, every single meal, chew your food. And you will notice the difference. I've had clients over the years who have literally only gone away and chewed their food properly. And they haven't, before they've even made any changes, like they haven't even received the written program from me yet, but they've already just started chewing their food better. And they already come back to me and say, I feel better already. I'm not bloated anymore. I've got more energy. I'm sleeping better, because now they are actually absorbing, they're breaking down their food properly, and they're actually absorbing the nutrients from it. So they're getting the nutrients from the food that they probably weren't getting before. And they don't have the GI symptoms that they were having from the fermentation of the undigested food. And they're not allowing these unfriendly bacteria to grow anymore. So that is a really, really important one. Digestive support, like taking a good quality digestive enzyme with your meals, can be helpful to help break down your foods. It doesn't mean you don't need to chew. It just helps even more, which is really important. And I think anyone 40 plus could really do with digestive enzyme support with their meal. So you would just take usually one capsule of a good quality digestive enzyme with a meal. That helps to reduce gas, bloating, and again, help you to actually absorb the nutrients from those meals. Now I get all my supplements and all the supplements that I recommend to my clients from a quality supplements dispensary, which all has different brands. There's not one particular brand that we, you know, sponsor or anything. It's just a very good quality supplements dispensary. They only stock good quality brands. You know, they have the highest integrity level, so they wouldn't stock anything that isn't, you know, really, really well researched and good quality. So it's called The Natural Dispensary. It's thenaturaldispensary.co.uk. And any of my clients and my community can get 10% off all of your orders using the code Francesca with a capital F at checkout. Now, we can also look at bile support. So considering bile support for your gallbladder. This is especially important if you have had your gallbladder removed, but even if, you know, if you haven't, either way, again, 40 plus, we could do with just supporting digestion a little bit more than in our previous years. So bile support, for example, you could take a bile acid supplement, something known as TUDCA, T-U-D-C-A, is just the short word for the really long scientific word for what TUDCA is, which I can't remember off the top of my head. Or you can take something that's just called ox bile. So bile acids supplements are very helpful. You wouldn't have to maybe take them long term. Maybe you could just take them every other day if you're, you know, just trying to budget a little bit and you still want to have that support. But also increase bitter greens in your diet and herbs. That's really, really helpful as well to just kind of stimulate the gallbladder to produce bile. So bitter greens like rocket, you know, dandelion, if you can get hold of it, and things like that. And be aware of external sources that might disrupt your gut microbiome, your collection of bacteria. So things like alcohol, constant use of antibiotics and other kind of medications can have an impact. Anyone on the oral contraceptive pill, that's been shown to imbalance the microbiome. And if you're taking like long-term use of antimicrobials, you know, there's some people out there might just be reading things online about natural antimicrobials like high-strength garlic and black walnut and things like that, which are really great and they do have their place, and I use them in my clinic with clients. But some people, if they're self-prescribing, they might just be on these things long term, and that can have, you know, the opposite effect if we're on them for too long. So just being aware, I'd say definitely things like alcohol, stress as well has the ability to disrupt our gut microbiome. So just being aware of those things. So even if you just start with one of these steps, you should notice quickly the benefits. So again, if you want to do all of these things, you're not doing any of them, then just maybe start with one thing and then come back, re-listen and choose, you know, a second and a third and so on. This isn't a race. You don't have to improve your gut overnight. It could be something that you work on for the next 6 to 12 months. And, you know, just imagine where you'd be in a year's time if you implement everything one by one. So I hope this has been helpful. And as always, thank you for listening. And if you're enjoying my episodes and you're finding them helpful, please do leave a rating if you have time and a review on the podcast platform that you're using, whether it's Apple or Spotify, because that really helps the show to reach more people and become more visible. It won't become more visible, you know, it won't become visible in a search without reviews and ratings being added consistently. So I would really, really, really appreciate it if you helped me to get the podcast to grow and become more visible. So thank you again. I really appreciate you listening, and I will see you next time. Bye-bye.
If you found this episode helpful, then please share it with anyone else who you think could benefit. And consider leaving a rating and a review, as this will help the podcast to reach and help more people. And if you need more guidance on your own health journey, you can grab my free guide, 6 Steps to Mastering Your Hormones in Your 40s, over at francescaliparotti.com, where you can sign up for your free copy. Or you'll also find the link in the show notes.